Disc 7.
I am the dragon, and you call me insane? My movements are followed and recorded as avidly as those of a mighty guest star. Do you know about the guest star in 1054? Of course not. Your readers follow you like a child follows a slug track with his finger, and in the same tired loops of reason. Back to your shallow skull and potato face, as a slug follows his own slime back home. Before me, you are a slug in the sun. You are privy to a great becoming, and you recognize nothing. You are an ant in the afterbirth. It is in your nature to do one thing correctly. Before me, you rightly tremble. Fear is not what you owe me, Lowndes, you and the other Pissmires. You owe me awe. Dollarhide stood with his head down, his thumb and forefinger against the bridge of his nose. Then he left the room. He didn't take off the mask, Lowndes thought. He didn't take off the mask. If he comes back with it off, I'm dead. God, I'm wet all over. He rolled his eyes toward the doorway and waited through the sounds from the back of the house. When Dollarhide returned, he still wore the mask. He carried a lunchbox and two thermoses. For your trip back home. He held up a thermos. Ice. We'll need that. Before we go, we'll tape a little while. He clipped a microphone to the Afghan near Lowndes' face. Repeat after me. They taped for half an hour. Finally, that's all, Mr. Lowndes. You did very well. You'll let me go now? I will. There's one way, though, that I can help you better understand and remember. Dollarhide turned away. I want to understand. I want you to know I appreciate you turning me loose. I'm really going to be fair from now on. You know that. Dollarhide could not answer. He had changed his teeth. The tape recorder was running again. He smiled at Lowndes, a brown-stained smile. He placed his hand on Lowndes' heart, and leaning to him intimately, as though to kiss him, he bit Lowndes' lips off and spit them on the floor. Chapter 21. Dawn in Chicago, heavy air and the gray sky low. A security guard came out of the lobby of the Tatler building and stood at the curb, smoking a cigarette and rubbing the small of his back. He was alone on the street, and in the quiet he could hear the clack of the traffic light changing at the top of the hill, a long block away. Half a block north of the light, out of the guard's sight, Francis Dollarhide squatted beside Lowndes in the back of the van. He arranged the blanket in a deep cowl that hid Lowndes' head. Lowndes was in great pain. He appeared stuporous, but his mind was racing. There were things he must remember. The blindfold was tented across his nose, and he could see Dollarhide's fingers checking the crusted gag. Dollarhide put on the white jacket of a medical orderly, laid a thermos in Lowndes' lap, and rolled him out of the van. When he locked the wheels of the chair and turned to put the ramp back in the van, Lowndes could see the end of the van's bumper beneath his blindfold. Turning now, seeing the bumper guard. Yes, the license plate. Only a flash, but Lowndes burned it into his mind. Rolling now, sidewalk seams, around a corner and down a curb. Paper crackled under the wheels. Dollarhide stopped the wheelchair in a bit of littered shelter between a garbage dumpster and a parked truck. He pulled at the blindfold. Lowndes closed his eyes, an ammonia bottle under his nose. The soft voice, close beside him. Can you hear me? You're almost there. The blindfold off now. blink if you can hear me. Dollarhide opened his eye with a thumb and forefinger. Lowndes was looking at Dollarhide's face. I told you one fib, Dollarhide tapped the thermos. I don't really have your lips on ice. He whipped off the blanket and opened the thermos. Lowndes strained hard when he smelled the gasoline, separating the skin from under his forearms and making the stout chair groan. The gas was cold all over him, fumes filling his throat, and they were rolling toward the center of the street. "Do you like being Graham's pet, Freedy?" Lit with a whump and shoved, sent rolling down on the tattler. "Eek, eek, eek," the wheels. The guard looked up as a scream blew the burning gag away. He saw the fireball coming, bouncing on the potholes, trailing smoke and sparks, and the flames blown back like wings, disjointed reflections leaping along the shop windows. It veered, struck a parked car, and overturned in front of the building, one wheel spinning and flames through the spokes, blazing arms rising in the fighting posture of the burned. The guard ran back into the lobby. He wondered if it would blow up, if he should get away from the windows. He pulled the fire alarm. What else? He grabbed the fire extinguisher off the wall and looked outside. It hadn't blown up yet. The guard approached cautiously through the greasy smoke spreading low over the pavement and, at last, sprayed foam on Freddy Lowndes. Chapter 22. The schedule called for Graham to leave the staked-out apartment in Washington at 5:45 a.m., well ahead of the morning rush. Crawford called while he was shaving. "Good morning." "Not so good," Crawford said. "The Tooth Fairy got Lowndes in Chicago." "Oh, hell no." "He's not dead yet, and he's asking for you. He can't wait long." "I'll go." "Meet me at the airport, United 245. It leaves in 40 minutes. You can be back for the stakeout if it's still on." Special Agent Chester from the Chicago FBI office met them at O'Hare in a downpour. Chicago is a city used to sirens. The traffic parted reluctantly in front of them as Chester howled down the expressway, his red light flashing pink on the driving rain. He raised his voice above the siren. "Chicago PD says he was jumped in his garage. My stuff is second-hand. We're not popular around here today." "How much is out?" Crawford said. "The whole thing. Trap. All of it." "Did Lowndes get a look at him?" "I haven't heard a description. Chicago PD put out an all-points bulletin for a license number about 6:20. "Did you get hold of Dr. Bloom for me?" "I got his wife, Jack. Dr. Bloom had his gallbladder taken out this morning." "Glorious," Crawford said. Chester pulled under the dripping hospital portico. He turned in his seat. "Jack, Will, before you go up, I hear this fruit really trashed Lowndes. You ought to be ready for that." Graham nodded. All the way to Chicago, he had tried to choke his hope that Lowndes would die before he had to see him. The corridor of Page Burn Center was a tube of spotless tile. A tall doctor with a curiously old young face beckoned Graham and Crawford away from the knot of people at Lowndes' door. "Mr. Lowndes' burns are fatal," the doctor said. "I can help him with the pain, and I intend to do it. He breathed flames, and his throat and lungs are damaged. He may not regain consciousness. In his condition, that would be a blessing. In the event that he does regain consciousness, the city police have asked me to take the airway out of his throat so that he might possibly answer questions. I've agreed to try that, briefly. At the moment, his nerve endings are anesthetized by fire. A lot of pain is coming, if he lives that long. I made this clear to the police, and I want to make it clear to you. I'll interrupt any attempted questioning to sedate him if he wants me to. Do you understand me?" "Yes," Crawford said. With a nod to the patrolman in front of the door, the doctor clasped his hands behind his white lab coat and moved away like a wading egret. Crawford glanced at Graham. You okay?
I'm okay.
I had the SWAT team. Lown's head was elevated in the bed. His hair and ears were gone, and compresses over his sightless eyes replaced the burned-off lids. His gums were puffed with blisters. The nurse beside him moved an IV stand so Graham could come close. Lowndes smelled like a stable fire.
Freddy, it's Will Graham.
Lowndes arched his neck against the pillow.
The movement's just reflex. He's not conscious, the nurse said.
The plastic airway holding open his scorched and swollen throat hissed in time with the respirator. A pale detective sergeant sat in the corner with a tape recorder and a clipboard on his lap. Graham didn't notice him until he spoke.
Lowndes said your name in the emergency room before they put the airway in.
You were there?
Later I was there, but I've got what he said on tape. He gave the fireman a license number when they first got to him. He passed out, and he was out in the ambulance, but he came around for a minute in the emergency room when they gave him a shot in the chest. Some Tatler people had followed the ambulance. They were there. I have a copy of their tape.
Let me hear it. The detective fiddled with his tape recorder.
I think you want to use the earphone, he said, his face carefully blank.
He pushed the button. Graham heard voices, the rattle of casters.
Put him in there.
The bump of a litter on a swinging door, a retching cough, and a voice croaking, speaking without lips.
Tooth, Harry.
Freddy, did you see him? What did he look like, Freddy?
Wendy, please, Wendy. Graham set me up. The cunt knew it. Graham set me up. Cunt took his hand on me in the picture like a fucking tenth. Wendy.
A noise like a drain sucking. A doctor's voice.
That's it. Let me get there. Get out of the way. Now.
That was all. Graham stood over Lowndes while Crawford listened to the tape.
We're running down the license number, the detective said. Could you understand what he was saying?
Who's Wendy? Crawford asked.
That hooker in the hall. The blonde with the chest. She's been trying to see him. She doesn't know anything.
Why don't you let her in? Graham said from the bedside. His back was to them.
No visitors.
The man's dying.
Think I don't know it? I've been here since a quarter to fucking 6 o'clock. Excuse me, nurse.
Take a few minutes, Crawford said. Get some coffee. Put some water on your face. He can't say anything. If he does, I'll be here with the recorder.
Okay, I could use it.
When the detective was gone, Graham left Crawford at the bedside and approached the woman in the hall.
Wendy?
Yeah?
If you're sure you want to go in there, I'll take you.
I want to. Maybe I ought to go comb my hair?
It doesn't matter, Graham said. When the policeman returned, he didn't try to put her out.
Wendy of Wendy City held Lowndes's blackened claw and looked straight at him.
He stirred once, a little before noon.
"It's going to be just fine, Roscoe," she said. "We'll have us some high old times."
Lowndes stirred again and died. Chapter 23 Captain Osborne of Chicago Homicide had the gray, pointed face of a stone fox. Copies of the Tatler were all over the police station. One was on his desk. He didn't ask Crawford and Graham to sit down.
You had nothing at all working with Lowndes in the city of Chicago?
No, he was coming to Washington, Crawford said. He had a plane reservation. I'm sure you've checked it.
Yeah, I got it. He left his office about 1:30 yesterday, got jumped in the garage of his building. Must have been about 2:10.
Anything in the garage?
His keys got kicked under his car. There's no garage attendant. They had a radio-operated door, but it came down on a couple of cars and they took it out. So nobody saw it happen. That's getting to be the refrain today. We're working on his car.
Can we help you there?
You can have the results when I get them.
You haven't said much, Graham. You had plenty to say in the paper.
I haven't heard much either, listening to you. You pissed off, Captain? Crawford said.
Me? Why should I be? We run down a phone trace for you and collar a fucking news reporter. Then you've got no charges against him. You have got some deal with him, gets him cooked in front of this scandal sheet. Now the other papers adopt him like he was their own. Now we've got our own Tooth Fairy murder right here in Chicago. That's great. Tooth Fairy in Chicago, boy. Before midnight, we'll have 6 accidental domestic shootings. Guy trying to sneak in his own house, drunk. Wife hears him. Bang. The Tooth Fairy may like Chicago, decide to stay around, have some fun.
We can do like this, Crawford said. Butt heads. Get the police commissioner and the U.S. attorney all stirred up. Get all the assholes stirred up, yours and mine. Or we can settle down and try to catch the bastard. This was my operation, and it went to shit. I know that.
You ever have that happen right here in Chicago? I don't want to fight you, Captain. We want to catch him and go home. What do you want?
Osborne moved a couple of items on his desk, a pen holder, a picture of a fox-faced child in band uniform. He leaned back in his chair, pursed his lips, and blew out some air.
Right now, I want some coffee. You guys want some?
I'd like some, Crawford said.
So would I,
Graham said.
Osborne passed around the styrofoam cups. He pointed to some chairs. The Tooth Fairy had to have a van or a panel truck to move Lowndes around in that wheelchair, Graham said.
Osborne nodded.
The license plate Lowndes saw was stolen off a TV repair truck in Oak Park. He took a commercial plate, so he was getting it for a truck or a van. He replaced the plate on the TV truck with another stolen plate so it wouldn't be noticed so fast. Very sly, this boy.
One thing we do know. He got the plate off the TV truck sometime after 8:30 yesterday morning. The TV repair guy bought gas first thing yesterday, and he used a credit card. The attendant copied the correct license number on the slip, so the plate was stolen after that.
Nobody saw any kind of truck or van, Crawford said.
Nothing.
The guard at the Tatler saw Zip. He could referee wrestling, he sees so little. The fire department responded first to the Tatler. They were just looking for fire. We're canvassing the overnight workers in the Tatler neighborhood, and the neighborhood's where the TV guy worked Tuesday morning. We hope somebody saw him cop the plate.
I'd like to see the chair again, Graham said. It's in our lab. I'll call them for you.
Osborne paused.
Lowndes was a ballsy little guy. You have to give him that.
Remembering the license number and spitting it out, the shape he was in.
You listened to what Lowndes said at the hospital?
Graham nodded.
I don't mean to rub this in, but I want to know if we heard it the same way. What does it sound like to you?
Graham quoted in a monotone. Tooth Fairy. Graham set me up. The cunt knew it. Graham set me up. Cunt put his hand on me in the picture like a fucking pet.
Osborne could not tell how Graham felt about it.
He asked another question.
He was talking about the picture of you and him in the Tatler?
Had to be.
Where would he get that idea?
Lowndes and I had a few run-ins.
But you looked friendly toward Lowndes in the picture. The Tooth Fairy kills the pet first. Is that it?
That's it.
The Stone Fox was pretty fast, Graham thought.
Too bad you didn't stake him out.
Graham said nothing.
Lowndes was supposed to be with us by the time the Tooth Fairy saw the Tatler, Crawford said.
Does what he said mean anything else to you? Anything we can use?
Graham came back from somewhere and had to repeat Osborne's question in his mind before he answered.
We know from what Lowndes said that the Tooth Fairy saw the Tatler before he hit Lowndes, right?
Right.
If you start with the idea that the Tatler set him off, does it strike you that he set this up in a hell of a hurry? The thing came off the press Monday night. He's in Chicago stealing license plates sometime Tuesday, probably Tuesday morning, and he's on top of Lowndes Tuesday afternoon.
What does that say to you?
That he saw it early, or he didn't have far to come, Crawford said. Either he saw it here in Chicago, or he saw it someplace else Monday night. Now bear in mind, he'd be watching for it to get the personal column.
Either he was already here, or he came from driving distance, Graham said. He was on top of Lowndes too fast, with a big old wheelchair you couldn't carry on a plane. It doesn't even fold. And he didn't fly here, steal a van, steal plates for it, and go around looking for an antique wheelchair to use. He had to have an old wheelchair. A new one wouldn't work for what he did. Graham was up, fiddling with the cord on the Venetian blinds, staring at the brick wall across the air shaft. He already had the wheelchair, or he saw it all the time. Osborne started to ask a question, but Crawford's expression cautioned him to wait. Graham was tying knots in the blind cord. His hands were not steady.
He saw it all the time, Crawford prompted.
Uh-huh, Graham said. You can see how the idea starts with the wheelchair. From the sight and thought of the wheelchair, that's where the idea would come from when he's thinking what he'll do to those fuckers. Freddy rolling down the street on fire. It must have been quite a sight.
Do you think he watched it?
Maybe. He certainly saw it before he did it, when he was making up his mind what he'd do. Osborne watched Crawford. Crawford was solid. Osborne knew Crawford was solid, and Crawford was going along with this. If he had the chair, or he saw it all the time, we can check around the nursing homes, the VA, Osborne said. It was perfect to hold Freddy still, Graham said. For a long time. He was gone 15 hours and 25 minutes, more or less, Osborne said. If he had just wanted to snuff Freddy, he could have done that in the garage, Graham said. He could have burned him in his car. He wanted to talk to Freddy, or hurt him for a while.
Either he did it in the back of the van, or he took him somewhere, Crawford said. That length of time, I'd say he took him somewhere. It had to be somewhere safe. If he bundled him up good, he wouldn't attract much notice around a nursing home going in and out. Osborne said. He'd have the racket, though, Crawford said. A certain amount of cleaning up to do. Assume he had the chair, and he had access to the van, and he had a safe place to take him to work on him. Does that sound like home? Osborne's telephone rang. He growled into it.
What? No, I don't want to talk to the tattler. Well, it better not be bullshit. Put her on. Captain Osborne, yes?
What time?
Who answered the phone initially, at the switchboard? Take her off the switchboard, please. Tell me again what he said. I'll have an officer there in 5 minutes.
Osborne looked at his telephone thoughtfully after he hung up. Lowndes' secretary got a call about 5 minutes ago, he said. She swears it was Lowndes' voice. He said something she didn't get, strength of the great red dragon. That's what she thought he said.
Chapter 24. Dr. Frederick Chilton stood in the corridor outside Hannibal Lecter's cell. With Chilton, there were three large orderlies. One carried a straitjacket and leg restraints, and another held a can of mace. The third loaded a tranquilizer dart into his air rifle. Lecter was reading an actuarial chart at his table and taking notes. He had heard the footsteps coming. He heard the rifle breech close behind him. But he continued to read and gave no sign that he knew Chilton was there. Chilton had sent him the newspapers at noon and let him wait until night to find out his punishment for helping the dragon.
Dr. Lecter, Chilton said. Lecter turned around.
Good evening, Dr. Chilton.
He didn't acknowledge the presence of the guards. He looked only at Chilton.
I've come for your books.
all your books. I see. May I ask how long you intend to keep them?
That depends on your attitude.
Is this your decision? I decide the punitive measures here. Of course you do. It's not the sort of thing Will Graham would request.
Back up to the net and slip these on, Dr. Lecter. I won't ask you twice.
Certainly, Dr. Chilton. I hope that's a 39. The 37's a snug around the chest.
Dr. Lecter put on the restraints as though they were dinner clothes. An orderly reached through the barrier and fastened them from the back.
Help him to his cot, Chilton said. While the orderlies stripped the bookshelves, Chilton polished his glasses and stirred Lecter's personal papers with a pen. Lecter watched from the shadowed corner of his cell. There was a curious grace about him, even in restraints.
Beneath the yellow folder, Lecter said quietly, you'll find a rejection slip the archives sent you. It was brought to me by mistake with some of my archives mail, and I'm afraid I opened it without looking at the envelope. Sorry.
Chilton reddened. He spoke to an orderly. I think you'd better take the seat off Dr. Lecter's toilet.
Chilton looked at the actuarial table. Lecter had written his age at the top, 41.
And what do you have here? Chilton asked.
Time,
Dr. Lecter said.
Section Chief Brian Zeller took the courier's case and the wheelchair wheels into instrumental analysis, walking at a rate that made his gabardine pants whistle. The staff, held over from the day shift, knew that whistling sound very well. Zeller, in a hurry. There had been enough delays. The weary courier, his flight from Chicago delayed by weather, and then diverted to Philadelphia, had rented a car and driven down to the FBI laboratory in Washington. The Chicago Police Laboratory is efficient, but there are things it is not equipped to do. Zeller prepared to do them now. At the mass spectrometer, he dropped off the paint flecks from Lown's car door. Beverly Katz in Hair and Fiber got the wheels to share with others in the section. Zeller's last stop was the small hot room, where Liza Lake bent over her gas chromatograph. She was testing ashes from a Florida arson case, watching the stylus trace its spiky line on the moving graph.
Ace lighter fluid, she said. That's what he lit it with.
She had looked at so many samples that she could distinguish brands without searching through the manual. Zeller took his eyes off Liza Lake and rebuked himself severely for feeling pleasure in the office. He cleared his throat and held up the two shiny paint cans.
Chicago? She said.
Zeller nodded. She checked the condition of the cans and the seal of the lids. One can contained ashes from the wheelchair, the other, charred material from Lowndes.
How long has it been in the cans?
6 hours, anyway, Zeller said.
I'll headspace it.
She pierced the lid with a heavy-duty syringe, extracted air that had been confined with the ashes, and injected the air directly into the gas chromatograph. She made minute adjustments. As the sample moved along the machine's 500-foot column, the stylus jiggled on the wide graph paper.
Unleaded, she said.
It's gasohol. Unleaded gasohol.
Don't see much of that.
She flipped quickly through a loose-leaf file of sample graphs. I can't give you a brand yet. Let me do it with pentane, and I'll get back to you.
Good, Zeller said.
Pentane would dissolve the fluid in the ashes, then fractionate early in the chromatograph, leaving the fluids for fine analysis. By 1 a.m., Zeller had all he could get. Liza Lake succeeded in naming the gasohol. Freddy Lowndes was burned with a Servco Supreme blend. Patient brushing in the grooves of the wheelchair treads yielded two kinds of carpet fiber— wool and synthetic.
Mold and dirt from the treads indicated the chair had been stored in a cool, dark place. The other results were less satisfactory. The paint flecks were not original factory paint. Blasted in the mass spectrometer and compared with the National Automotive Paint File, the paint proved to be high-quality Duco enamel manufactured in a lot of 186,000 gallons during the first quarter of 1978 for sale to several auto paint shop chains. Zeller had hoped to pinpoint a make of vehicle and the approximate time of manufacture. He telexed the results to Chicago. The Chicago Police Department wanted its wheels back. The wheels made an awkward package for the courier. Zeller put written lab reports in his pouch along with mail and a package that had come for Graham. "Federal Express, I'm not," the courier said when he was sure Zeller couldn't hear him. The Justice Department maintains several small apartments near 7th District Court in Chicago for the use of jurists and favored expert witnesses when court is in session. Graham stayed in one of these, with Crawford across the hall. He came in at 9 p.m., tired and wet. He had not eaten since breakfast on the plane from Washington, and the thought of food repelled him. Rainy Wednesday was over at last. It was as bad a day as he could remember. With Lowndes dead, it seemed likely that he was next, and all day Chester had watched his back while he was in Lowndes' garage, while he stood in the rain on the scorched pavement where Lowndes was burned. With strobe lights flashing in his face, he told the press he was grieved at the loss of his friend Frederick Lowndes. He was going to the funeral, too. So were a number of federal agents and police, in the hope that the killer would come to see Graham grieve. Actually, he felt nothing he could name, just cold nausea and an occasional wave of sickly exhilaration that he had not burned to death instead of Lowndes. It seemed to Graham that he had learned nothing in 40 years. He had just gotten tired. He made a big martini and drank it while he undressed. He had another after his shower while he watched the news. An FBI trap to catch the Tooth Fairy backfires, and a veteran reporter is dead. We'll be back with details on Eyewitness News after this. They were referring to the killer as the Dragon before the newscast was over. The Tattler had spilled it all to the networks. Graham wasn't surprised. Thursday's edition should sell well. He made a third martini and called Molly. She had seen the television news at 6 and 10 o'clock, and she had seen a Tattler. She knew that Graham had been the bait in a trap. "You should have told me, Will." "Maybe. I don't think so." "Will he try to kill you now?"
"Sooner or later. It would be hard for him now, since I'm moving around. I'm covered all the time, Molly, and he knows it. I'll be okay."
"You sound a little slurry. Have you been to see your friend in the fridge?"
"I had a couple."
"How do you feel?"
"Fairly rotten."
"The news said the FBI didn't have any protection for the reporter."
"He was supposed to be with Crawford by the time the Tooth Fairy got the paper."
"The news is calling him the Dragon now."
"That's what he calls himself."
"Will, there's something. I want to take Willie and leave here."
"And go where?"
"His grandparents. They haven't seen him in a while. They'd like to see him."
"Oh, uh-huh."
Willie's father's parents had a ranch on the Oregon coast. "It's creepy here. I know it's supposed to be safe, but we're not sleeping a whole lot. Maybe the shooting lessons spooked me. I don't know."
"I'm sorry, Molly. I wish I could tell you how sorry."
"I'll miss you. We both will."
So she had made up her mind.
"When are you going?" "In the morning."
"What about the shop?"
"Evelyn wants to take it. I'll underwrite the fall stuff with the wholesalers, just for the interest, and she can keep what she makes."
The dogs?
I asked her to call the county, Will. I'm sorry, but maybe somebody will take some of them.
Molly, if staying here, I could keep something bad from happening to you, I'd stay. But you can't save anybody, Will. I'm not helping you here. With us up there, you can just think about taking care of yourself. I'm not carrying this damned pistol the rest of my life, Will.
Maybe you can get down to Oakland and watch the A's. Didn't mean to say that. Oh, boy. This silence is getting pretty long.
Well, look, I'll call you, she said. Or I guess you'll have to call me up there.
Graham felt something tearing. He felt short of breath.
Let me get the office to make the arrangements. Have you made a reservation already? I didn't use my name. I thought maybe the newspapers.
Good. Good. Let me get somebody to see you off. You wouldn't have to board through the gate, and you'd get out of Washington absolutely clean.
Can I do that?
Let me do that. What time does the plane go?
9:40, American 118.
Okay. 8:30, behind the Smithsonian. There's a park right. Leave the car there. Somebody'll meet you. He'll listen to his watch, put it to his ear when he gets out of his car, okay?
That's fine.
Say, do you change at O'Hare? I could come out.
No, change in Minneapolis.
Oh, Molly. Maybe I could come up there and get you when it's over.
That would be very nice.
Very nice. Do you have enough money?
The bank's wiring me some.
What?
To Barclays at the airport. Don't worry.
I'll miss you.
Me too. But that'll be the same as now. Same distance by phone. Willie says hi.
Hi to Willie.
Be careful, darling.
She had never called him darling before.
He didn't care for it. He didn't care for new names. Darling, Red Dragon.
The night duty officer in Washington was glad to make the arrangements for Molly. Graham pressed his face to the cool window and watched sheets of rain whip over the muffled traffic below him, the street leaping from gray to sudden color in the lightning flashes. His face left a print of forehead, nose, lips, and chin on the glass. Molly was gone. The day was over, and there was only the night to face, and the lipless voice accusing him. Lowndes' woman held what was left of his hand until it was over.
"Hello, this is Valerie Leeds. I'm sorry I can't come to the phone right now."
"I'm sorry, too," Graham said.
Graham filled his glass again and sat at the table by the window, staring at the empty chair across from him. He stared until the space in the opposite chair assumed a man-shape, filled with dark and swarming motes, a presence like a shadow on suspended dust. He tried to make the image coalesce, to see a face. It would not move, had no countenance, but faceless, faced him with palpable attention.
"I know it's tough," Graham said. He was intensely drunk. "You've got to try to stop. Just hold off until we find you. If you got to do something, fuck, come after me. I don't give a shit. It'll be better after that. They've got some things now to help you make it stop. To help you stop wanting to so bad. Help me. Help me a little. Molly's gone. Old Freddy's dead. It's you and me now, sport."
He leaned across the table, his hand extended to touch, and the presence was gone. Graham put his head down on the table, his cheek on his arm. He could see the print of his forehead, nose, mouth, and chin on the window as the lightning flashed behind it, a face with drops crawling through it down the glass, eyeless, a face full of rain. Graham had tried hard to understand the dragon. At times, in the breathing silence of the victims' houses, the very spaces the dragon had moved through tried to speak. Sometimes Graham felt close to him,
A feeling he remembered from other investigations had settled over him in recent days. The taunting sense that he and the dragon were doing the same things at various times of the day, that there were parallels in the quotidian details of their lives. Somewhere the dragon was eating, or showering, or sleeping at the same time he did. Graham tried hard to know him. He tried to see him past the blinding glint of slides and vials, beneath the lines of police reports, tried to see his face through the louvers of print. He tried as hard as he knew how. But to begin to understand the dragon, to hear the cold drips in his darkness, to watch the world through his red haze, Graham would have had to see things he could never see. And he would have had to fly through time. Chapter 25. Springfield, Missouri, June 14th, 1938. Marion Dollarhide Trevane, tired and in pain, got out of a taxi at City Hospital. Hot wind whipped grit against her ankles as she climbed the steps. The suitcase she lugged was better than her loose wash dress, and so was the mesh evening bag she pressed to her swollen belly. She had 2 quarters and a dime in her bag. She had Francis Dollarhide in her belly. She told the admitting officer her name was Betty Johnson, a lie. She said her husband was a musician, but she did not know his whereabouts, which was true. They put her in the charity section of the maternity ward. She did not look at the patients on either side of her. She looked across the aisle at the soles of feet. In 4 hours, she was taken to the delivery room, where Francis Dollarhide was born. The obstetrician remarked that he looked more like a leaf-nosed bat than a baby, another truth. He was born with bilateral fissures in his upper lip and in his hard and soft palates. The center section of his mouth was unanchored and protruded. His nose was flat. The hospital supervisors decided not to show him to his mother immediately. They waited to see if the infant could survive without oxygen. They put him in a bed at the rear of the infant ward and faced him away from the viewing window. He could breathe, but he could not feed. With his palate cleft, he could not suck. His crying on the first day was not as continuous as that of a heroin-addicted baby, but it was as piercing. By the afternoon of the second day, a thin keening was all he could produce. When the shifts changed at 3 p.m., a wide shadow fell across his bed. Prince Easter Mize, 260 pounds, cleaning woman and aide in the maternity ward, stood looking at him, her arms folded on top of her bosom. In 26 years in the nursery, she had seen about 39,000 infants. This one would live if he ate. Prince Easter had received no instructions from the Lord about letting this infant die. She doubted that the hospital had received any either. She took from her pocket a rubber stopper pierced with a curved glass drinking straw. She pushed the stopper into a bottle of milk. She could hold the baby and support his head in one great hand. She held him to her breast until she knew he felt her heartbeat. Then she flipped him over and popped the tube down his throat. He took about 2 ounces and went to sleep. "Uh-huh," she said. She put him down and went about her assigned duties with the diaper pails. On the fourth day, the nurses moved Marion Dollarhide Trevane to a private room. Hollyhocks left over from a previous occupant were in an enamel pitcher on the washstand. They had held up pretty well. Marion was a handsome girl, and the puffiness was leaving her face. She looked at the doctor when he started talking to her, his hand on her shoulder. She could smell strong soap on his hand, and she thought about the crinkles at the corners of his eyes until she realized what he was saying. Then she closed her eyes and did not open them while they brought the baby in.
Finally, she looked. They shut the door when she screamed. Then they gave her a shot. On the fifth day, she left the hospital alone. She didn't know where to go. She could never go home again. Her mother had made that clear. Marion Dollarhide Trevane counted the steps between the light poles. Each time she passed three poles, she sat on the suitcase to rest. At least she had the suitcase. In every town there was a pawn shop near the bus station. She had learned that traveling with her husband. Springfield in 1938 was not a center for plastic surgery. In Springfield, you wore your face as it was. A surgeon at City Hospital did the best he could for Francis Dollarhide, first retracting the front section of his mouth with an elastic band, then closing the clefts in his lip by a rectangular flap technique that is now outmoded. The cosmetic results were not good. The surgeon had trouble to read up on the problem and decided correctly that repair of the infant's hard palate should wait until he was five. To operate sooner would distort the growth of his face. A local dentist volunteered to make an obturator, which plugged the baby's palate and permitted him to feed without flooding his nose. The infant went to the Springfield Foundling Home for a year and a half, and then to Morgan Lee Memorial Orphanage. Reverend S. B. Buddy Lomax was head of the orphanage. Brother Buddy called the other boys and girls together and told them that Francis was a hare lip, but they must be careful never to call him a hare lip. Brother Buddy suggested they pray for him. Francis Dollarhide's mother learned to take care of herself in the years following his birth. Marion Dollarhide first found a job typing in the office of a ward boss in the St. Louis Democratic machine. With his help, she had her marriage to the absent Mr. Trevane annulled. There was no mention of a child in the annulment proceedings. She had nothing to do with her mother. "I didn't raise you to slut for that Irish trash," were Mrs. Dollarhide's parting words to Marion when she left home with Trevane. Marion's ex-husband called her once at the office. Sober and pious, he told her he had been saved and wanted to know if he, Marion, and the child he never had the joy of knowing might make a new life together. He sounded broke. Marion told him the child was born dead, and she hung up. He showed up drunk at her boarding house with his suitcase. When she told him to go away, he observed that it was her fault the marriage failed and the child was stillborn. He expressed doubt that the child was his. In a rage, Marion Dollarhide told Michael Trevane exactly what he had fathered and told him he was welcome to it. She reminded him that there were two cleft palates in the Trevane family. She put him in the street and told him never to call her again. He didn't. But years later, drunk and brooding over Marion's rich new husband and her fine life, he did call Marion's mother. He told Mrs. Dollarhide about the deformed child and said her snag teeth proved the hereditary fault lay with the Dollarhides. A week later, a Kansas City streetcar cut Michael Trevane in two. When Trevane told Mrs. Dollarhide that Marion had a hidden son, she sat up most of the night. Tall and lean in her rocker, Grandmother Dollarhide stared into the fire. Toward dawn, she began a slow and purposeful rocking. Somewhere upstairs in the big house, a cracked voice called out of sleep. The floor above Grandmother Dollarhide creaked as someone shuffled toward the bathroom. A heavy thump on the ceiling, someone falling, and the cracked voice called in pain. Grandmother Dollarhide never took her eyes off the fire. She rocked faster, and, in time, the calling stopped. Near the end of his fifth year, Francis Dollarhide had his first and only visitor at the orphanage.
He was sitting in the thick reek of the cafeteria when an older boy came for him and took him to Brother Buddy's office. The lady waiting with Brother Buddy was tall and middle-aged, dredged in powder, her hair in a tight bun. Her face was stark white. There were touches of yellow in the gray hair and in the eyes and teeth. What struck Francis, what he would always remember, she smiled with pleasure when she saw his face. That had never happened before her. No one would ever do it again. "This is your grandmother," Brother Buddy said. "Hello," she said. Brother Buddy wiped his own mouth with a long hand. "Say hello. Go ahead." Francis had learned to say some things by occluding his nostrils with his upper lip, but he did not have much occasion for hello.
"Hello," was the best he could do.
Grandmother seemed even more pleased with him. "Can you say grandmother?"
"Try to say grandmother," Brother Buddy said.
The plosive G defeated him. Francis strangled easily on tears. A red wasp buzzed and tapped against the ceiling. "Never mind," his grandmother said. "I'll just bet you can say your name. I just know a big boy like you can say his name. Say it for me." The child's face brightened. The big boys had helped him with this. He wanted to please. He collected himself. "Cunt face," he said. 3 days later, Grandmother Dollarhide called for Francis at the orphanage and took him home with her. She began at once to help him with his speech. They concentrated on a single word. It was mother. Within 2 years of the annulment, Marion Dollarhide met and married Howard Vogt, a successful lawyer with solid connections to the St. Louis machine and what was left of the old Pendergast machine in Kansas City. Vogt was a widower with 3 young children, an affable, ambitious man 15 years older than Marion Dollarhide. He hated nothing in the world except the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, which had singed his feathers in the voter registration scandal of 1936 and blasted the attempt in 1940 by the St. Louis machine to steal the governorship. By 1943, Vogt's star was rising again. He was a brewery candidate for the state legislature and was mentioned as a possible delegate to the upcoming state constitutional convention. Marion was a useful and attractive hostess, and Vogt bought her a handsome, half-timbered house on Olive Street that was perfect for entertaining. Francis Dollarhide had lived with his grandmother for a week when she took him there. Grandmother had never seen her daughter's house. The maid who answered the door did not know her. "I'm Mrs. Dollarhide," she said, barging past the servant. Her slip was showing 3 inches in the back. She led Francis into a big living room with a pleasant fire.
"Who is it, Viola?"
a woman's voice from upstairs. Grandmother cupped Francis's face in her hand. He could smell the cold leather glove. An urgent whisper. "Go see Mother, Francis. Go see Mother. Run." He shrank from her, twisting on the tines of her eyes. "Go see Mother. Run." She gripped his shoulders and marched him toward the stairs. He trotted up to the landing and looked back down at her. She motioned upward with her chin. Up to the strange hallway toward the open bedroom door. Mother was seated at her dressing table, checking her makeup in a mirror framed with lights. She was getting ready for a political rally, and too much rouge wouldn't do. Her back was to the door.
"Mother,"
Francis piped, as he had been taught. He tried hard to get it right.
"Mother."
She saw him in the mirror then. "If you're looking for Ned, he isn't home from..."
"Munner."
He came into the heartless light. Marion heard her mother's voice downstairs, demanding tea. Her eyes widened, and she sat very still. She did not turn around. She turned out the makeup lights and vanished from the mirror. In the darkened room, she gave a single, low keening that ended in a sob. It might have been for herself, or it might have been for him. Grandmother took Francis to all the political rallies after that, and explained who he was and where he came from. She had him say hello to everyone. They did not work on hello at home. Mr. Vogt lost the election by 1,800 votes. Chapter 26. At Grandmother's house, Francis Dollarhide's new world was a forest of blue-veined legs. Grandmother Dollarhide had been running her nursing home for 3 years when he came to live with her. Money had been a problem since her husband's death in 1936. She had been brought up a lady, and she had no marketable skills. What she had was a big house and her late husband's debts. Taking in boarders was out. The place was too isolated to be a successful boarding house. She was threatened with eviction. The announcement in the newspaper of Marion's marriage to the affluent Mr. Howard Vogt had seemed a godsend to Grandmother. She wrote to Marion repeatedly for help, but received no answer. Every time she telephoned, a servant told her Mrs. Vogt was out. Finally, bitterly, Grandmother Dollarhide made an arrangement with the county and began to take in elderly, indigent persons. For each one, she received a sum from the county and erratic payments from such relatives as the county could locate. It was hard until she began to get some private patients from middle-class families. No help from Marion all this time, and Marion could have helped. Now Francis Dollarhide played on the floor in the forest of legs. He played cards with Grandmother's mahjong pieces, pushing them among feet twisted like gnarled roots. Mrs. Dollarhide could keep clean-washed dresses on her residence, but she despaired at trying to make them keep on their shoes. The old people sat all day in the living room listening to the radio. Mrs. Dollarhide had put in a small aquarium for them to watch as well, and a private contributor had helped her cover her parquet floors with linoleum against the inevitable incontinence. They sat in a row on the couches and in wheelchairs, listening to the radio, their faded eyes fixed on the fish, or on nothing, or something they saw long ago. Francis would always remember the shuffle of feet on linoleum in the hot and buzzing day, and the smell of stewed tomatoes and cabbage from the kitchen. The smell of the old people, like meat wrappers dried in the sun. And always the radio. Rinso white, rinso bright, happy little wash day song. Francis spent as much time as he could in the kitchen because his friend was there. The cook, Queen Mother Bailey, had grown up in the service of the late Mr. Dollarhide's family. She sometimes brought Francis a plum in her apron pocket, and she called him Little Possum, always dreamin'. The kitchen was warm and safe, but Queen Mother Bailey went home at night. December 1943. Francis Dollarhide, 5 years old, lay in bed in his upstairs room in Grandmother's house. The room was pitch dark, with its blackout curtains against the Japanese. He could not say Japanese. He needed to pee. He was afraid to get up in the dark. He called to his grandmother in bed downstairs.
"Emma! Emma!"
He sounded like an infant goat. He called until he was tired.
"Mlizi, Emma."
It got away from him then, hot on his legs and under his seat, and then cold, his nightdress sticking to him. He didn't know what to do. He took a deep breath and rolled over to face the door. Nothing happened to him. He put his foot on the floor.
He stood up in the dark, nightdress plastered to his legs, face burning. He ran for the door. The doorknob caught him over the eye, and he sat down in wetness, jumped up, and ran down the stairs, fingers squealing on the banister. To his grandmother's room. Crawling across her in the dark and under the covers, warm against her now. Grandmother stirred, tensed, her back hardened against his cheek, voice hissing. "I've never she..." A clatter on the bedside table as she found her teeth, clacket as she put them in.
This is the end of Disc 7. Disc 8.
"I've never seen a child as disgusting and dirty as you. Get out! Get out of this bed!" She turned on the bedside lamp. He stood on the carpet shivering. She wiped her thumb across his eyebrow. Her thumb came away bloody. "Did you break something?" He shook his head so fast, droplets of blood fell on grandmother's nightgown. "Upstairs. Go on." The dark came down over him as he climbed the stairs. He couldn't turn on the lights because grandmother had cut the cords off short so only she could reach them. He did not want to get back in the wet bed. He stood in the dark, holding on to the footboard for a long time. He thought she wasn't coming. The blackest corners in the room knew she wasn't coming. She came, snatching the short cord on the ceiling light, her arms full of sheets. She did not speak to him as she changed the bed. She gripped his upper arm and pulled him down the hall to the bathroom. The light was over the mirror, and she had to stand on tiptoe to reach it. She gave him a washcloth, wet and cold. "Take off your nightshirt and wipe yourself off." Smell of adhesive tape and the bright sewing scissors clicking. She snipped out a butterfly of tape, stood him on the toilet lid, and closed the cut over his eye. "Now," she said. She held the sewing scissors under his round belly, and he felt cold down there. "Look," she said. She grabbed the back of his head and bent him over to see his little penis lying across the bottom blade of the open scissors. She closed the scissors until they began to pinch him. "Do you want me to cut it off?" He tried to look up at her, but she gripped his head. He sobbed, and spit fell on his stomach. "Do you?"
"No, Emma. No, Emma."
"I pledge you my word, if you ever make your bed dirty again, I'll cut it off. Do you understand?"
"Yeah, Emma."
"You can find the toilet in the dark, and you can sit on it like a good boy. You don't have to stand up. Now go back to bed." At 2 a.m., the wind rose, gusting warm out of the southeast, clacking together the branches of the dead apple trees, rustling the leaves of the live ones. The wind drove warm rain against the side of the house, where Francis Dollarhide, 42 years old, lay sleeping. He lay on his side, sucking his thumb, his hair damp and flat on his forehead and his neck. Now he awakes. He listens to his breathing in the dark and the tiny clicks of his blinking eyes. His fingers smell faintly of gasoline. His bladder is full. He feels on the bedside table for the glass containing his teeth. Dollarhide always puts in his teeth before he rises. Now he walks to the bathroom. He does not turn on the light. He finds the toilet in the dark and sits down on it like a good boy. Chapter 27. The change in grandmother first became apparent in the winter of 1947, when Frances was 8. She stopped taking meals in her room with Frances. They moved to the common table in the dining room, where she presided over meals with the elderly residents.
Grandmother had been trained as a girl to be a charming hostess, and now she unpacked and polished her silver bell and put it beside her plate. Keeping a luncheon table going, pacing the service, managing conversation, batting easy conversational lobs to the strong points of the shy ones, turning the best facets of the bright ones in the light of the other guests' attention, is a considerable skill, and one now sadly in decline. Grandmother had been good at it in her time. Her efforts at this table did brighten meals initially for the two or three among the residents who were capable of linear conversation. Frances sat in the host's chair at the other end of the avenue of nodding heads as Grandmother drew out the recollections of those who could remember. She expressed keen interest in Mrs. Floater's honeymoon trip to Kansas City, went through the yellow fever with Mr. Eaton a number of times, and listened brightly to the random, unintelligible sounds of the others. "Isn't that interesting, Frances?" she said, and rang the bell for the next course. The food was a variety of vegetable and meat mushes, but she divided it into courses, greatly inconveniencing the kitchen help. Mishaps at the table were never mentioned. A ring of the bell and a gesture in mid-sentence took care of those who had spilled or gone to sleep or forgotten why they were at the table. Grandmother always kept as large a staff as she could pay. As Grandmother's general health declined, she lost weight and was able to wear dresses that had long been packed away. Some of them were elegant. In the cast of her features and her hairstyle, she bore a marked resemblance to George Washington on the dollar bill. Her manners had slipped somewhat by spring. She ruled the table and permitted no interruptions as she told of her girlhood in St. Charles, even revealing personal matters to inspire and edify Frances and the others. It was true that Grandmother had enjoyed a season as a belle in 1907 and was invited to some of the better balls across the river in St. Louis. There was an object lesson in this for everyone, she said. She looked pointedly at Francis, who crossed his legs beneath the table. I came up at a time when little could be done medically to overcome the little accidents of nature, she said. I had lovely skin and hair, and I took full advantage of them. I overcame my teeth with force of personality and bright spirits, so successfully, in fact, that they became my beauty spot. I think you might even call them my charming trademark. I wouldn't have traded them for the world. She distrusted doctors, she explained at length. But when it became clear that gum problems would cost her her teeth, she sought out one of the most renowned dentists in the Midwest, Dr. Felix Bertel, a Swiss. Dr. Bertel's Swiss teeth were very popular with a certain class of people, Grandmother said, and he had a remarkable practice. Opera singers, fearing that new shapes in their mouths would affect their tone, actors and others in public life came from as far away as San Francisco to be fitted. Dr. Bertel could reproduce a patient's natural teeth exactly, and had experimented with various compounds and their effect on resonance. When Dr. Bertel had completed her dentures, her teeth appeared just as they had before. She overcame them with personality and lost none of her unique charm, she said with a spiky smile. If there was an object lesson in all this, Frances did not appreciate it until later. There would be no further surgery for him until he could pay for it himself. Francis could make it through dinner because there was something he looked forward to afterward. Queen Mother Bailey's husband came for her each evening in the mule-drawn wagon he used to haul firewood. If Grandmother was occupied upstairs, Francis could ride with them down the lane to the main road. He waited all day for the evening ride, sitting on the wagon seat beside Queen Mother, her tall, flat husband, silent and almost invisible in the dark,
the iron tires of the wagon loud in the gravel behind the jingle of the bits. Two mules, brown and sometimes muddy, their cropped manes standing up like brushes, swishing their tails across their rumps. The smell of sweat and boiled cotton cloth, snuff and warm harness. There was the smell of wood smoke when Mr. Bailey had been clearing new ground, and sometimes, when he took his shotgun to the new ground, a couple of rabbits or squirrels lay in the wagon box, stretched long as though they were running. They did not talk on the ride down the lane. Mr. Bailey spoke only to the mules. The wagon motion bumped the boy pleasantly against the Baileys. Dropped off at the end of the lane, he gave his nightly promise to walk straight back to the house, and watched the lantern on the wagon move away. He could hear them talking down the road. Sometimes Queen Mother made her husband laugh, and she laughed with him. Standing in the dark, it was pleasant to hear them and know they were not laughing at him. Later, he would change his mind about that. Frances Dollarhide's occasional playmate was the daughter of a sharecropper who lived three fields away. Grandmother let her come to play because it amused her now and then to dress the child in the clothing Marion had worn when she was small. She was a red-haired, listless child, and she was too tired to play much of the time. One hot June afternoon, bored with fishing for doodlebugs in the chicken yard with straws, she asked to see Francis's private parts. In a corner between the chicken house and a low hedge that shielded them from the lower windows of the house, he showed her. She reciprocated by showing him her own, standing with her pilled cotton underwear around her ankles. As he squatted on his heels to see, a headless chicken flapped around the corner, traveling on its back, flapping up the dust. The hobbled girl hopped backward as it spattered blood on her feet and legs. Francis jumped to his feet, his trousers still down, as Queen Mother Bailey came around the corner after the chicken and saw them.
"Look here, boy," she said calmly. "You want to see what's what. Well, now you see. So go on and find yourself something else to do. Occupy yourself with children's doings and keep your clothes on. You and that child helped me catch that rooster."
The children's embarrassment quickly passed as the rooster eluded them. But Grandmother was watching from the upstairs window. Grandmother watched Queen Mother come back inside. The children went into the chicken house. Grandmother waited 5 minutes, then came up on them silently. She flung open the door and found them gathering feathers for headdresses. She sent the girl home and led Francis into the house. She told him he was going back to Brother Buddy's orphanage after she had punished him. "Go upstairs. Go to your room and take your trousers off and wait for me while I get my scissors." He waited for hours in his room, lying on the bed with his trousers off, clutching the bedspread and waiting for the scissors. He waited through the sounds of supper downstairs, and he heard the creak and clop of the firewood wagon and the snort of the mules as Queen Mother's husband came for her. Sometime toward morning he slept, and woke in starts to wait. Grandmother never came. Perhaps she had forgotten. He waited through the routine of the days that followed, remembering many times a day in a rush of freezing dread. He would never cease from waiting. He avoided Queen Mother Bailey, would not speak to her, and wouldn't tell her why. He mistakenly believed that she had told Grandmother what she saw in the chicken yard. Now he was convinced that the laughter he heard while he watched the wagon lantern diminish down the road was about him. Clearly, he could trust no one. It was hard to lie still and go to sleep when it was there to think about. It was hard to lie still on such a bright night. Francis knew that Grandmother was right. He had hurt her so. He had shamed her.
Everyone must know what he had done, even as far away as St. Charles. He was not angry at Grandmother. He knew that he loved her very much. He wanted to do right. He imagined that burglars were breaking in, and he protected Grandmother, and she took back what she said. "You're not a child of the devil, after all, Francis. You are my good boy." He thought about a burglar breaking in, coming in the house determined to show Grandmother his private parts. How would Francis protect her? He was too small to fight a big burglar. He thought about it. There was Queen Mother's hatchet in the pantry. She wiped it with newspaper after she killed a chicken. He should see about the hatchet. It was his responsibility. He would fight his fear of the dark if he really loved Grandmother. He should be the thing to be afraid of in the dark, the thing for the burglar to be afraid of. He crept downstairs and found the hatchet hanging on its nail. It had a strange smell, like the smell at the sink when they were drawing a chicken. It was sharp, and its weight was reassuring in his hand. He carried the hatchet to Grandmother's room to be sure there were no burglars. Grandmother was asleep. It was very dark, but he knew exactly where she was. If there was a burglar, he would hear him breathing just as he could hear Grandmother breathing. He would know where his neck was just as surely as he knew where Grandmother's neck was. It was just below the breathing. If there was a burglar, he would come up on him quietly like this. He would raise the hatchet over his head with both hands like this. Francis stepped on Grandmother's slipper beside the bed. The hatchet swayed in the dizzy dark and pinged against the metal shade of her reading lamp. Grandmother rolled over and made a wet noise with her mouth. Francis stood still. His arms trembled from the effort of holding up the hatchet. Grandmother began to snore. The love Francis felt almost burst him. He crept out of the room. He was frantic to be ready to protect her. He must do something. He did not fear the dark house now, but it was choking him. He went out the back door and stood in the brilliant night, face upturned, gasping as though he could breathe the light. A tiny disk of moon, distorted on the whites of his rolled-back eyes, rounded as the eyes rolled down, and was centered at last in his pupils. The love swelled in him unbearably tight, and he could not gasp it out. He walked toward the chicken house, hurrying now, the ground cold under his feet, the hatchet bumping cold against his leg, running now before he burst. Francis, scrubbing himself at the chicken yard pump, had never felt such sweet and easy peace. He felt his way cautiously into it and found that the peace was endless and all around him. What Grandmother kindly had not cut off was still there, like a prize, when he washed the blood off his belly and legs. His mind was clear and calm. He should do something about the nightshirt. Better hide it under the sacks in the smokehouse. Discovery of the dead chicken puzzled Grandmother. She said it didn't look like a fox job. A month later, Queen Mother found another one when she went to gather eggs. This time, the head had been wrung off. Grandmother said at the dinner table that she was convinced it was done for spite by some sorry help I ran off. She said she had called the sheriff about it. Francis sat silent at his place, opening and closing his hand on the memory of an eye blinking against his palm. Sometimes in bed, he held himself to be sure he hadn't been cut. Sometimes, when he held himself, he thought he felt a blink. Grandmother was changing rapidly. She was increasingly contentious and could not keep household help. Though she was short of housekeepers, it was the kitchen where she took personal charge, directing Queen Mother Bailey to the detriment of the food. Queen Mother, who had worked for the Dollar Hides all her life, was the only constant on the staff. red-faced in the kitchen heat, Grandmother moved restlessly from one task to the next, often leaving dishes half-made, never to be served. She made casseroles of leftovers while vegetables wilted in the pantry. At the same time, she became fanatical about waste. She reduced the soap and bleach in the wash until the sheets were dingy gray. In the month of November, she hired 5 different black women to help in the house. They would not stay. Grandmother was furious the evening the last one left. She went through the house yelling. She came into the kitchen and saw that Queen Mother Bailey had left a teaspoonful of flour on the board after rolling out some dough. In the steam and heat of the kitchen, a half hour before dinner, she walked up to Queen Mother and slapped her face. Queen Mother dropped her ladle, shocked. Tears sprang into her eyes. Grandmother drew back her hand again. A big pink palm pushed her away.
"Don't you ever do that. You're not yourself, Mrs. Dollarhide, but don't you ever do that."
Screaming insults, Grandmother, with her bare hand, shoved over a kettle of soup to slop and hiss down through the stove. She went to her room and slammed the door. Frances heard her cursing in her room and objects thrown against the walls. She didn't come out again all evening. Queen Mother cleaned up the soup and fed the old people. She got her few things together in a basket and put on her old sweater and stocking cap. She looked for Frances, but couldn't find him. She was in the wagon when she saw the boy sitting in the corner of the porch. He watched her climb down heavily and come back to him.
"Possum, I'm going now. I won't be back here. Saronia at the feed store, she'll call your mama for me. You need me before your mama get here. You come to my house."
He twisted away from the touch on his cheek. Mr. Bailey clucked to the mules. Frances watched the wagon lantern move away. He had watched it before, with a sad and empty feeling since he understood that Queen Mother betrayed him. Now he didn't care. He was glad. A feeble kerosene wagon light fading down the road. It was nothing to the moon. He wondered how it feels to kill a mule. Marion Dollarhide Vogt did not come when Queen Mother Bailey called her. She came 2 weeks later after a call from the sheriff in St. Charles. She arrived in mid-afternoon, driving herself in a pre-war Packard. She wore gloves and a hat. A deputy sheriff met her at the end of the lane and stooped to the car window.
"Mrs. Vogt, your mother called our office around noon, saying something about the help stealing. When I come out here, you'll excuse me, but she was talking out of her head, and it looked like things wasn't tended to. Sheriff thought he ought to get hold of y'all first, if you understand me, Mr. Vogt being before the public and all."
Marion understood him. Mr. Vogt was Commissioner of Public Works in St. Louis now and was not in the party's best graces.
"To my knowledge, nobody else has saw the place," the deputy said.
Marion found her mother asleep. 2 of the old people were still sitting at the table waiting for lunch. 1 woman was out in the backyard in her slip. Marion telephoned her husband.
"How often do they inspect these places? They must not have seen anything. I don't know if any relatives have complained. I don't think these people have any relatives."
"No, no, you stay away. I need some Negroes. Get me some Negroes. And Dr. Waters. I'll take care of it." The doctor, with an orderly in white, arrived in 45 minutes, followed by a panel truck bringing Marion's maid and 5 other domestics. Marion, the doctor, and the orderly were in Grandmother's room when Frances came home from school. Frances could hear his grandmother cursing. When they rolled her out in one of the nursing home wheelchairs, she was glassy-eyed, and a piece of cotton was taped to her arm. Her face looked sunken and strange without her teeth. Marion's arm was bandaged, too. She had been bitten. Grandmother rode away in the doctor's car, sitting in the back seat with the orderly. Francis watched her go. He started to wave, but let his hand fall back to his side. Marion's cleaning crew scrubbed and aired the house, did a tremendous wash, and bathed the old people. Marion worked alongside them and supervised a sketchy meal. She spoke to Francis only to ask where things were. Then she sent the crew away and called the county authorities. Mrs. Dollarhide had suffered a stroke, she explained. It was dark when the welfare workers came for the patients in a school bus. Francis thought they would take him, too. He was not discussed. Only Marion and Francis remained at the house. She sat at the dining room table with her head in her hands. He went outside and climbed a crabapple tree. Finally, Marion called him. She had packed a small suitcase with his clothes. "You'll have to come with me," she said, walking to the car. "Get in. Don't put your feet on the seat." They drove away in the Packard and left the empty wheelchair standing in the yard. There was no scandal. The county authorities said it was sure a shame about Mrs. Dollarhide. She sure kept things nice. The Vogts remained untarnished. Grandmother was confined to a private nerve sanatorium. It would be 14 years before Francis went home to her again. "Francis, here are your stepsisters and stepbrother," his mother said. They were in the Vogts' library. Ned Vogt was 12, Victoria 13, and Margaret 9. Ned and Victoria looked at each other. Margaret looked at the floor. Francis was given a room at the top of the servants' stairs. Since the disastrous election of 1944, the Vogts no longer employed an upstairs maid. He was enrolled in Potter Gerard Elementary School, within walking distance of the house, and far from the Episcopal private school the other children attended. The Vogt children ignored him as much as possible during the first few days, but at the end of the first week, Ned and Victoria came up the servants' stairs to call. Francis heard them whispering for minutes before the knob turned on his door. When they found it bolted, they didn't knock. Ned said, "Open this door." Francis opened it. They did not speak to him again while they looked through his clothes in the wardrobe. Ned Vogt opened the drawer in the small dressing table and picked up the things he found with two fingers. Birthday handkerchiefs with FD embroidered on them, a capo for a guitar, a bright beetle in a pill bottle, a copy of Baseball Joe in the World Series, which had once been wet, and a get-well card signed, "Your classmate, Sarah Hughes." "What's this?" Ned asked. "A capo." "What's it for?"
"A guitar."
"Do you have a guitar?"
"No."
"What do you have it for?" Victoria asked.
"My father used it."
"I can't understand you. What did you say? Make him say it again, Ned." "He said it belonged to his father." Ned blew his nose on one of the handkerchiefs and dropped it back in the drawer. "They came for the ponies today," Victoria said. She sat on the narrow bed. Ned joined her, his back against the wall, his feet on the quilt. "No more ponies," Ned said. "No more lake house for the summer. Do you know why? Speak up, you little bastard."
"Father is sick a lot and doesn't make as much money," Victoria said. "Some days he doesn't go to the office at all."
"Know why he's sick, you little bastard?" Ned asked. "Talk where I can understand you."
"Grandmother said he's a drunk. Understand that, all right?"
"He's sick because of your ugly face," Ned said.
"That's why people didn't vote for him, too," Victoria said.
"Get out," Francis said. When he turned to open the door, Ned kicked him in the back. Francis tried to reach his kidney with both hands, which saved his fingers as Ned kicked him in the stomach.
"Oh, Ned," Victoria said. "Oh, Ned."
Ned grabbed Francis by the ears and held him close to the mirror over the dressing table. "That's why he's sick."
Ned slammed his face into the mirror.
That's why he's sick.
Slam.
That's why he's sick.
Slam. The mirror was smeared with blood and mucus. Ned let him go, and he sat on the floor. Victoria looked at him, her eyes wide, holding her lower lip between her teeth. They left him there. His face was wet with blood and spit. His eyes watered from the pain, but he did not cry. Chapter 28. Rain in Chicago drums through the night on the canopy over the open grave of Freddie Lowndes. Thunder jars Will Graham's pounding head as he weaves from the table to a bed where dreams coil beneath the pillow. The old house above St. Charles, shouldering the wind, repeats its long sigh over the hiss of rain against the windows and the bump of thunder. The stairs are creaking in the dark. Mr. Dollarhide is coming down them, his kimono whispering over the treads, his eyes wide with recent sleep. His hair is wet and neatly combed. He has brushed his nails. He moves smoothly and slowly, carrying his concentration like a brimming cup. Film beside his projector. Two subjects. Other reels are piled in the wastebasket for burning. Two left, chosen from the dozens of home movies he has copied at the plant and brought home to audition. Comfortable in his reclining chair, with a tray of cheese and fruit beside him, Dollarhide settles in to watch. The first film is a picnic from the 4th of July weekend. A handsome family, three children, the father bull-necked, dipping into the pickle jar with his thick fingers, and the mother. The best view of her is in the softball game with the neighbor's children, only about 15 seconds of her. She takes a lead off second base, faces the pitcher and the plate, feet apart, ready to dash either way, her breasts swaying beneath her pullover as she leans forward from the waist. An annoying interruption as a child swings a bat. The woman again, walking back to tag up. She puts one foot on the boat cushion they use for a base and stands hip-shot, the thigh muscle tightening in her locked leg. Over and over, Dollarhide watches the frames of the woman. Foot on the base, pelvis tilts, thigh muscle tightens under the cut-off jeans. He freezes the last frame. The woman and her children. They are dirty and tired. They hug, and a dog wags among their legs. A terrific crash of thunder clinks the cut crystal in grandmother's tall cabinet. Dollarhide reaches for a pair. The second film is in several segments. The title, The New House, is spelled out in pennies on a shirt cardboard above a broken piggy bank. It opens with Father pulling up the for sale sign in the yard. He holds it up and faces the camera with an embarrassed grin. His pockets are turned out. An unsteady, long shot of Mother and three children on the front steps. It is a handsome house, a cut to the swimming pool. A child, sleek-headed and small, pads around to the diving board, leaving wet footprints on the tile. Heads bob in the water. A small dog paddles toward a daughter, his ears back, chin high, and the whites of his eyes showing. Mother in the water holds to the ladder and looks up at the camera. Her curly black hair has the gloss of pelt. Her bosom swelling, shining wet above her suit, her legs wavy below the surface, scissoring. Night. A badly exposed shot across the pool to the lighted house, the lights reflected in the water. Indoors and family fun. Boxes everywhere and packing materials. An old trunk not yet stored in the attic. A small daughter is trying on grandmother's clothes. She has on a big garden party hat. Father is on the sofa. He looks a little drunk. Now Father must have the camera. It is not quite level. Mother is at the mirror in the hat. The children jostle around her, the boys laughing and plucking at the old finery. The girl watches her mother coolly, appraising herself in time to come. A close-up. Mother turns and strikes a pose for the camera with an arch smile, her hand at the back of her neck. She's quite lovely. There is a cameo at her throat. Dollarhide freezes the frame. He backs up the film. Again and again she turns from the mirror and smiles. Absently, Dollarhide picks up the film of the softball game and drops it in the wastebasket. He takes the reel from the projector and looks at the Gateway label on the box. Bob Sherman, Star Route 7, Box 603, Tulsa, Oklahoma. An easy drive, too. Dollarhide holds the film in his palm and covers it with his other hand as though it were a small living thing that might struggle to escape. It seems to jump against his palm like a cricket. He remembers the jerkiness, the haste at the Leeds house when the lights came on. He had to deal with Mr. Leeds before turning on his movie lights. This time, he wants a smoother progression. It would be wonderful to crawl in between the sleepers with the camera going and snuggle up a little while. Then he could strike in the dark and sit up between them happily getting wet. He can do that with infrared film, and he knows where to get some. The projector is still on. Dollarhide sits holding the film between his hands, while on the bright blank screen other images move for him to the long sigh of the wind. There is no sense of vengeance in him, only love and thoughts of the glory to come. Hearts becoming faint and fast, like footsteps fleeing into silence. Him rampant, him rampant, filled with love, the Shermans opening to him. The past does not occur to him at all, only the glory to come. He does not think of his mother's house. In fact, his conscious memories of that time are remarkably few and indistinct. Sometime in his 20s, Dollarhide's memories of his mother's house sank out of sight, leaving a slick on the surface of his mind. He knew that he had lived there only a month. He did not recall that he was sent away at the age of 9 for hanging Victoria's cat. One of the few images he retained was the house itself, lighted, viewed from the street in winter twilight as he passed it going from Potter Gerard Elementary School to the house where he was boarded a mile away. He could remember the smell of the Vogt Library, like a piano just opened, when his mother received him there to give him holiday things. He did not remember the faces at the upstairs windows as he walked away, down the frozen sidewalk, the practical gifts burning hateful under his arm, hurrying home to a place inside his head that was quite different from St. Louis. At the age of 11, his fantasy life was active and intense, and when the pressure of his love grew too great, he relieved it. He preyed on pets, carefully, with a cool eye to consequence. They were so tame that it was easy. The authorities never linked him with the sad little bloodstains soaked into the dirt floors of garages. At 42, he did not remember that. Nor did he ever think about the people in his mother's house, his mother, stepsisters, or stepbrother. Sometimes he saw them in his sleep, in the brilliant fragments of a fever dream, altered and tall, faces and bodies in bright parrot colors, they poised over him in a mantis stance. When he chose to reflect, which was seldom, he had many satisfactory memories. They were of his military service. Caught at 17, entering the window of a woman's house, for a purpose never established, he was given the choice of enlisting in the army or facing criminal charges. He took the army. After basic training, he was sent to specialist school in darkroom operation and shipped to San Antonio, where he worked on Medical Corps training films at Brooke Army Hospital. Surgeons at Brooke took an interest in him and decided to improve his face. They performed a Z-plasty on his nose, using ear cartilage to lengthen the columella, and repaired his lip with an interesting Abbe flap procedure that drew an audience of doctors to the operating theater. The surgeons were proud of the result. Dollarhide declined the mirror and looked out the window. Records at the film library show Dollarhide checked out many films, mainly on trauma, and kept them overnight. He re-enlisted in 1958, and in his second hitch, he found Hong Kong. Stationed at Seoul, Korea, developing film from the tiny spotter planes the Army floated over the 38th parallel in the late 1950s, he was able to go to Hong Kong twice on leave. Hong Kong and Kowloon could satisfy any appetite in 1959. Grandmother was released from the sanatorium in 1961 in a vague Thorazine piece. Dollarhide asked for and received a hardship discharge 2 months before his scheduled separation date and went home to take care of her. It was a curiously peaceful time for him as well. With his new job at Gateway, Dollarhide could hire a woman to stay with Grandmother in the daytime. At night, they sat in the parlor together, not speaking. The tick of the old clock and its chimes were all that broke the silence. He saw his mother once, at Grandmother's funeral in 1970. He looked through her, past her, with his yellow eyes so startlingly like her own. She might have been a stranger. His appearance surprised his mother. He was deep-chested and sleek, with her fine coloring and a neat mustache, which she suspected was hair transplanted from his head. She called him once in the next week and heard the receiver slowly replaced. For 9 years after Grandmother's death, Dollarhide was untroubled, and he troubled no one. His forehead was as smooth as a seed. He knew that he was waiting. For what? He didn't know. One small event, which occurs to everyone, told the seed in his skull it was time. Standing by a north window, examining some film, he noticed aging in his hands. It was as though his hands holding the film had suddenly appeared before him, and he saw in that good north light that the skin had slackened over the bones and tendons, and his hands were creased in diamonds as small as lizard scales. As he turned them in the light, an intense odor of cabbage and stewed tomatoes washed over him. He shivered, though the room was warm. That evening, he worked out harder than usual. A full-length mirror was mounted on the wall of Dollarhide's attic gym beside his barbells and weight bench. It was the only mirror hanging in his house, and he could admire his body in it comfortably because he always worked out in a mask. He examined himself carefully while his muscles were pumped up. At 40, he could have competed successfully in regional bodybuilding competition. He was not satisfied. Within the week, he came upon the Blake painting. It seized him instantly. He saw it in a large full-color photograph in Time magazine, illustrating a report on the Blake retrospective at the Tate Museum in London. The Brooklyn Museum had sent the great red dragon and the woman clothed with the sun to London for the show. Time's critic said, "Few demonic images in Western art radiate such a nightmarish charge of sexual energy." Dollarhide didn't have to read the text to find that out. He carried the picture with him for days, photographed and enlarged it in the darkroom late at night. He was agitated much of the time. He posted the painting beside his mirror in the weight room and stared at it while he pumped. He could sleep only when he had worked out to exhaustion and watched his medical films to aid him in sexual relief. He had known since the age of 9 that essentially he was alone, and that he would always be alone, a conclusion more common to the 40s. Now, in his 40s, he was seized by a fantasy life with the brilliance and freshness and immediacy of childhood. It took him a step beyond alone. At a time when other men first see and fear their isolation, Dollarhide's became understandable to him. He was alone because he was unique. With the fervor of conversion, he saw that if he worked at it, if he followed the true urges he had kept down for so long, cultivated them as the inspirations they truly were, he could become. The dragon's face is not visible in the painting, but increasingly Dollarhide came to know how it looked. Watching his medical films in the parlor, pumped up from lifting, he stretched his jaw wide to hold in grandmother's teeth. They did not fit his distorted gums, and his jaw cramped quickly. He worked on his jaw in private moments, biting on a hard rubber block until the muscles stood out in his cheeks like walnuts. In the fall of 1979, Francis Dollarhide withdrew part of his considerable savings and took a 3-month leave of absence from Gateway. He went to Hong Kong, and he took with him his grandmother's teeth. When he returned, red-haired Eileen and his other fellow workers agreed that the vacation had done him good. He was calm. They hardly noticed that he never used the employees' locker room or shower anymore. He had never done that often anyway. His grandmother's teeth were back in the glass beside her bed. His own new ones were locked in his desk upstairs. If Eileen could have seen him before his mirror, teeth in place, new tattoo, brilliant in the harsh gym light, she would have screamed once. There was time now. He did not have to hurry now. He had forever. It was 5 months before he selected the Jacobies. The Jacobies were the first to help him, the first to lift him into the glory of his becoming. The Jacobies were better than anything he ever knew, until the Leedses. And now, as he grew in strength and glory, there were the Shermans to come, and the new intimacy of infrared. Most promising. Chapter 29. Francis Dollarhide had to leave his own territory at Gateway Film Processing to get what he needed. Dollarhide was production chief of Gateway's largest division, home movie processing, but there were 4 other divisions. The recessions of the 1970s cut deeply into home movie making, and there was increasing competition from home video recorders. Gateway had to diversify. The company added departments which transferred film to videotape, printed aerial survey maps, and offered custom services to small-format commercial filmmakers. In 1979, a plum fell to Gateway. The company contracted jointly with the Department of Defense and the Department of Energy to develop and test new emulsions for infrared photography. The Department of Energy wanted sensitive infrared film for its heat conservation studies. Defense wanted it for night reconnaissance. Gateway bought a small company next door, Bader Chemical, in late 1979, and set up the project there. Dollarhide walked across to Bader on his lunch hour, under a scrubbed blue sky, carefully avoiding the reflecting puddles on the asphalt. Lowndes' death had put him in an excellent humor. Everyone at Bader seemed to be out for lunch. He found the door he wanted at the end of a labyrinth of halls. The sign beside the door said, "Infrared sensitive materials in use. No safe lights. No smoking. No hot beverages." The red light was on above the sign. Dollarhide pushed a button, and in a moment the light turned green. He entered the light trap and rapped on the inner door. "Come," a woman's voice. Cool, absolute darkness, the gurgle of water, the familiar smell of D-76 developer, and a trace of perfume. I'm Francis Dollarhide. I came about the dryer.
Oh, good. Excuse me. My mouth's full. I was just finishing lunch.
He heard papers wadded and dropped in a wastebasket.
Actually, Ferguson wanted the dryer, said the voice in the dark. He's on vacation, but I know where it goes. You have one over at Gateway?
I have two. One is larger. He didn't say how much room he has.
Dollarhide had seen a memo about the dryer problem weeks ago. I'll show you, if you don't mind a short wait.
All right.
Put your back against the door. Her voice took on a touch of the lecturer's practice tone. Come forward 3 steps until you feel the tile under your feet, and there'll be a stool just to your left.
He found it. He was closer to her now. He could hear the rustle of her lab apron.
Thanks for coming down, she said. Her voice was clear, with a faint ring of iron in it. You're head of processing over in the big building, right?
Uh-huh.
The same Mr. D who sends the rockets when the requisitions are filed wrong?
The very one.
I'm Reba McLean. Hope there's nothing wrong over here.
Not my project anymore.
I just planned the darkroom construction when we bought this place. I haven't been over here in 6 months.
A long speech for him. Easier in the dark.
Just a minute more, and we'll get you some light. Do you need a tape measure?
I have one.
Dollarhide found it rather pleasant, talking to the woman in the dark. He heard the rattle of a purse being rummaged, the click of a compact. He was sorry when the timer rang.
There we go.
I'll put this stuff in the black hole, she said. He felt a breath of cold air, heard a cabinet close on rubber seals, and the hiss of a vacuum lock. A puff of air and fragrance touched him as she passed. Dollarhide pressed his knuckle under his nose, put on his thoughtful expression, and waited for the light. The lights came on. She stood by the door, smiling in his approximate direction. Her eyes made small random movements behind the closed lids. He saw her white cane propped in the corner. He took his hand away from his face and smiled.
"Do you think I could have a plum?" he said. There were several on the counter where she had been sitting.
"Sure, they're really good."
Reba McLean was about 30, with a handsome prairie face, shaped by good bones and resolution. She had a small star-shaped scar on the bridge of her nose. Her hair was a mixture of wheat and red gold, cut in a page boy that looked slightly out of date, and her face and hands were pleasantly freckled by the sun. Against the tile and stainless steel of the darkroom, she was as bright as fall. He was free to look at her. His gaze could move over her as freely as the air. She had no way to parry eyes.
Dollarhide often felt warm spots, stinging spots on his skin when he talked to a woman. They moved over him to wherever he thought the woman was looking. Even when a woman looked away from him, he suspected that she saw his reflection. He was always aware of reflective surfaces, knew the angles of reflection as a pool shark knows the banks. His skin now was cool. Hers was freckled, pearly on her throat and the insides of her wrists.
"I'll show you the room where he wants to put it," she said. "We can get the measuring done."
They measured.
"Now, I want to ask a favor," Dollarhide said.
"Okay."
"I need some infrared movie film, hot film, sensitive up around 1,000 nanometers.
You'll have to keep it in the freezer and put it back in the cold after you shoot."
"I know."
"Could you give me an idea of the conditions? Maybe I..."
"Shooting at maybe 8 feet with a pair of rattan filters over the lights?"
It sounded too much like a surveillance rig.
"At the zoo," he said. "In the world of darkness, they want to photograph the nocturnal animals."
"They must really be spooky if you can't use commercial infrared."
"Uh-huh." I'm sure we can fix you up. One thing, though. You know, a lot of our stuff is under the DD contract. Anything that goes out of here, you have to sign for.
Right.
When do you need it?
About the 20th. No later.
I don't have to tell you, the more sensitive it is, the meaner it is to handle. You get into coolers, dry ice, all that. They're screening some samples about 4 o'clock, if you want to look. You can pick the tamest emulsion that'll do what you want.
I'll come.
Reba McLean counted her plums after Dollarhide left. He had taken one.
Strange man, Mr. Dollarhide. There had been no awkward pause of sympathy and concern in his voice when she turned on the lights. Maybe he already knew she was blind. Better yet, maybe he didn't give a damn. That would be refreshing.
Chapter 30. In Chicago, Freddie Lowndes' funeral was underway. The National Tatler paid for the elaborate service, rushing the arrangements so that it could be held on Thursday, the day after his death. Then the pictures would be available for the Tatler edition, published Thursday night. The funeral was long in the chapel, and it was long at the graveside. A radio evangelist went on and on in fulsome eulogy. Graham rode the greasy swells of his hangover and tried to study the crowd. The hired choir at graveside gave full measure for the money, while the Tatler photographer's motor-driven cameras whizzed. Two TV crews were present with fixed cameras and creepy peepees. Police photographers with press credentials photographed the crowd. Graham recognized several plainclothes officers from Chicago Homicide. Theirs were the only faces that meant anything to him. And there was Wendy of Wendy City, Lowndes' girlfriend. She was seated beneath the canopy nearest the coffin. Graham hardly recognized her. Her blonde wig was drawn back in a bun, and she wore a black tailored suit. During the last hymn, she rose, went forward unsteadily, knelt, and laid her head on the casket, her arms outstretched in the pall of chrysanthemums as the strobe lights flashed. The crowd made little noise moving over the spongy grass to the cemetery gates. Graham walked beside Wendy. A crowd of the uninvited stared at them through the bars of the high iron fence.
"Are you all right?" Graham asked.
They stopped among the tombstones. Her eyes were dry, her gaze level.
"Better than you," she said. "Got drunk, didn't you?"
"Yep."
"Is somebody keeping an eye on you?"
"The precinct sent some people over. They've got plain clothes in the club. Lots of business now. More weirdos than usual."
"I'm sorry you had this. You did. I thought you were fine at the hospital. I admired that."
She nodded. "Freddie was a sport. He shouldn't have to go out that hard. Thanks for getting me in the room." She looked into the distance, blinking, thinking, eye shadow like stone dust on her lids. She faced Graham.
"Look, the Tatler's giving me some money. You figured that, right? For an interview and the dive at the graveside. I don't think Freddie would mind."
"He'd have been mad if you passed it up."
"That's what I thought. They're jerks, but they pay. What it is, they tried to get me to say that I think you deliberately turned this freak onto Freddie, chumming with him in that picture. I didn't say it. If they print that I did say it, well, that's bullshit."
Graham said nothing as she scanned his face.
"You didn't like him, maybe. It doesn't matter. But if you thought this could happen, you wouldn't have missed the shot at the ferry, right?"
"Yeah, Wendy. I'd have staked him out."
"Do you have anything at all? I hear noise from these people, and that's about it."
"We don't have much. A few things from the lab we're following up. It was a clean job, and he's lucky."
"Are you?"
"What?"
"Lucky.
Off and on."
"Freddie was never lucky. He told me he'd clean up on this. Big deals everywhere."
"He probably would have, too." Well, look, Graham, if you ever, you know, feel like a drink, I've got one.
Thanks.
But stay sober on the street.
Oh, yes.
Two policemen cleared a path for Wendy through the crowd of curiosity seekers outside the gate. One of the gawkers wore a printed T-shirt reading, "The Tooth Fairy is a one-night stand." He whistled at Wendy. The woman beside him slapped his face. A big policeman squeezed into the 280ZX beside Wendy, and she pulled into the traffic. A second policeman followed in an unmarked car. Chicago smelled like a spent skyrocket in the hot afternoon. Graham was lonely, and he knew why. Funerals often make us want sex. It's one in the eye for death. The wind rattled the dry stalks of a funeral arrangement near his feet. For a hard second, he remembered palm fronds rustling in the sea wind. He wanted very much to go home, knowing that he would not, could not, until the dragon was dead.
This is the end of Disc 8.